This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Monday, the 27th of October, these are our main stories. The BBC comes face to face with former Islamic State fighters in a Syrian prison as IS increases attacks in the northeast of the country. In Argentina's midterm elections, President Milei's party achieves a landslide victory. The French authorities make arrests in connection to last week's theft of crown jewels from the Louvre Museum. Also in this podcast, Venezuela's Attorney General reacts to US assertions that it's fighting a war against drug traffickers there.
This is not an issue of democracy. It's about taking away Venezuela's gold, oil, copper and iron. Venezuela is one of the richest countries on the planet.
And the Indian weavers devastated by Donald Trump's tariffs.
2 months ago, I was making $180 a day. Now I barely make 80. We've taken a loan to cover the expenses. And I'm scared. If I fail to repay it, they'll take my land.
We begin in Syria, where Islamic State fighters have regrouped in the wake of the collapse of the Bashar al-Assad regime and are increasing their attacks on the Kurdish-controlled northeast of the country. When the IS caliphate fell several years ago, some 8,000 suspected fighters were imprisoned in Syria, and thousands of their relatives were herded into makeshift camps in desolate conditions. Some countries have repatriated their nationals, but many from the UK have been stripped of their citizenship and are still in Syria. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, sent this special report from the northeast of the country.
We've just arrived at the entrance to Al-Sana'a prison, the largest jail for IS detainees. We've been asked to wear masks. Prison authorities tell us tuberculosis is rife here. It's very rare to get access inside this prison. Security is extremely tight. Locked gates, bolted doors, guards every few steps. IS suspects have been held here for years, including some former leaders. And counter-terrorism officials here tell us they believe the men here are still a threat. One of the detainees has been brought out. He's from London. His name is Hamza Pervez and he's 32. How did you come to join Islamic State?
I found out about the Islamic State through the internet. I heard that they wanted to implement a version of Sharia law.
But Islamic State was also involved in kidnapping, in enslaving Yazidi women, in beheading. Were you okay with all of that?
A lot of these things that happened throughout the 5 years of Islamic State were very unfortunate. There's a lot of things that I don't agree with, and there are a few things that happen in Islamic State that I do agree with.
Unfortunate seems like a very tame word to describe beheadings and killings and rape and kidnapping of women.
Definitely, a lot of unfortunate and a lot of horrific things do happen at war.
What would you say to the British government?
I would say that me and the rest of the British citizens that are here in the prison, we don't wish any harm.
Well, how can people be sure of that, given what you did, given what IS did? How can people possibly accept that you're not a threat?
It's not going to be easy, but they're going to have to take my word for it. It's something that I can't convince people about. I do think about it a lot. It's a huge risk that they would have to take to bring us back. It's true.
Whatever Hamza Pervez is guilty of, he hasn't been tried or convicted. The same goes for other Western IS detainees and their families. Thousands of their wives and children are being arbitrarily detained in desolate, tented camps. A new generation is growing up here, and there are concerns that this place could be an incubator for radicalisation. We meet a mother of four from London. Mihak Aslam would like to go home, but she has been stripped of her British citizenship. She denies joining IS, but admits bringing her children to its territory, where her eldest daughter was killed in an explosion. You say you're very worried about the conditions here. They're not good for the children. Why not let them go home?
This was offered a while ago, which I declined. Unfortunately, my children have pretty much grown up just in camp. This is life. They don't know a world outside. Two of my children were born in Syria. They've never seen Britain. And going to family who, again, they don't know, it will be very, very difficult.
But your youngest is only 8, as I understand. Do you really, you're choosing to keep an 8-year-old here in these conditions?
It's not that I'm choosing to. I don't think I should have to make that choice. No mother should have to make that choice of being separated from her children.
But you chose to go to a country where at that stage the Islamic State was established. It was killing people. It was beheading people. It was throwing people off buildings. It was kidnapping and raping Yazidi women. All of this was going on. And you chose to come to this place.
So initially, we heard obviously they're very harsh in the way they deal with their prisoners. I wasn't aware of the Yazidi thing in the beginning at the time, or the people being thrown off the buildings. We didn't witness any of this. We knew they were very extreme.
The future of this camp and of the families here isn't a problem just for Syria. There are about 2,000 foreigners here. Many are Westerners from countries including Britain and France and America. The Kurds are concerned that some of those here are a security risk. Many of their countries don't want them back for exactly the same reason.
Orla Guerin, reporting from Syria. In Argentina, it seems that voters have largely decided to give the thumbs up to President Javier Milei's policy of cutting state spending. He took office 2 years ago, promising a shock therapy of budget cuts and deregulation. He wasn't directly up for re-election in Sunday's elections. They were midterm contests for half of Argentina's lower chamber of deputies, as well as a third of the Senate. Our correspondent, Ione Wells, is in Buenos Aires.
Here at the hotel in Buenos Aires, where Javier Milei has been watching the results, his supporters have been cheering this landslide victory for the president and his libertarian coalition. His party gained 6 additional seats in the Senate, bringing their total to 13, and 27 seats in the lower house of Congress, bringing their total to 64. That means his party and its allies will comfortably have a third of the lower house's seats. This was seen as a key threshold for him to reach in order for Congress to back his presidential decrees and block opposition bills. The result is also likely to, at least for now, calm financial markets that had been jittery about how sustainable his economic program was. Donald Trump had also made it clear that a $20 billion currency swap lifeline the US had offered Argentina hinged on Javier Milei's political success.
Ione Wells in Buenos Aires. Next, to Paris, where the French authorities have made arrests in connection to last week's theft of crown jewels from the Louvre Museum. One of the suspects was detained at Charles de Gaulle Airport, while the other was arrested in northern Paris. Jewels worth around $100 million were taken from the world's most visited museum last Sunday when 4 thieves wielding power tools broke into the building in broad daylight. Experts think abandoned objects during the Louvre theft led to the suspect's identification. Christian Flesch is a former director of the Judicial Police.
The circumstances of the theft itself were rather curious, since there were 4 individuals who arrived, then left, wanting to set something on fire but didn't, and left behind a jacket and gloves. There are many elements that the forensic police undoubtedly examined, along with the Paris Forensic Laboratory. All of this has undoubtedly provided clues that have been decisive in identifying the people who were at the scene or who participated in the robbery.
Our Europe editor Katia Adler told my colleague Celia Hatton more about the people who were arrested.
What we don't know is whether indeed they are 2 of the 4 robbers or 2 people connected to the robberies. What French media reports say is that both men arrested are known to the French police in connection to what's being described as previous sophisticated robberies. Other suspects are still at large. You have more than 100 detectives who are said to be working on the case. Considering that the men apprehended were connected with sophisticated robberies, I mean, on the one hand, yes, an audacious robbery. I mean, incredible, broad daylight, put up a ladder normally used for, you know, house removals, like furniture removals, glass cutting, inside, accessing these precious crown jewels, mainly linked to Napoleon III, out on the ladder on mopeds across the city of Paris. But then those mopeds were tracked by CCTV cameras. They left, as we've heard, all this DNA evidence aside. That doesn't seem very sophisticated. So it is a curious affair. It's ignited imaginations across the world. Social media has gone wild, mocking the heist. And it's embarrassing for the Louvre, which, you know, is the most visited museum in the world. It's embarrassing for the French authorities, because it also brings to light the fact that French museums are often targeted because, you know, security is underfunded compared to, say, French banks or, you know, high-end jewellery stores here in Paris.
And Katia, of course, what about the fate of the jewels?
It was quite a sloppy getaway in that, you know, at least one of the items fell out of the bag. What it's thought is that what the robbers will have wanted to do is to break up the jewels, to take off the precious jewels, maybe make them smaller, sell them off in smaller pieces, and when it comes to the precious metals, to melt them down. Now, we don't know whether that's already been done. And so, yes, they could still be recovered in theory, but also in some cases it may be too late.
Katia Adler in Paris. In Sweden, a handful of mechanics are taking on one of the world's richest companies. The strike at Tesla's workshops has now reached its second anniversary. It's a clash of ideologies in which each side has much at stake. And after 2 years, there's no prospect of a resolution, as Tim Mansell reports.
I've just arrived in Uppsala. It's a 40-minute train ride from Stockholm, the capital of Sweden. I'm on my way out to meet Hanna Ericsson and her brother, Conrad. They're both Tesla technicians, and they're both out on strike.
If your union says you go on strike, then you go on strike.
Conrad Ericsson is 29. He used to work for a truck company, but his sister Hanna persuaded him to join Tesla. Conrad, you went out on strike on the first day.
Yeah.
Tell me why you did that.
Front and foremost, because I believe in the Swedish model, that we should have a balance between the employer and the employees.
In Sweden, the majority of workers are members of a union. The union negotiates their pay and conditions to reach what's called a collective agreement. But in Sweden, Tesla has shown little interest in negotiating with the IF Metall union. The union's president is Marie Nilsson.
We try to sit down with the company and discuss collective agreement, but they wouldn't respond, and we got the impression that they tried to hide away or not discuss this with us.
When the strike began, Hanna, who's 33, was working front of house for Tesla. She found herself in a tricky position. On the one hand, she wanted to do her job to the best of her ability. On the other hand, she supported the strike.
I wanted a collective agreement. I wasn't comfortable saying that out loud, and I could definitely not tell that to the customers. But I also had to do my job.
Then Hanna changed jobs and became a technician. That meant she could join the union, and that meant she could join the strike.
It was scary, but it was also a relief, because now I can finally say out loud what I actually believe in.
About 70 of Tesla's mechanics are on strike, but they haven't succeeded in closing Tesla's workshops, partly because not all their colleagues joined them, and partly because Tesla has employed other mechanics to take the place of those who walked out. This, says Hermann Bender, who works at a union-funded think tank, Arena Idea, in Stockholm, is something no Swedish employer would do.
And that's a dimension that's important to understand in this dispute. It's not only a dispute between an employer and a union, but it's also a conflict between the Swedish model and an American corporate culture, which is more authoritarian and more managerial.
Tesla's chief executive, Elon Musk, has made clear his distaste for unions. Here he is, speaking at a New York Times event in 2023.
I disagree with the idea of unions, but perhaps for a reason that is different than people may expect, which is I just don't like anything which creates kind of a lords and peasants sort of thing. And I think the unions naturally try to create negativity in a company and create a...
This is not the general view in Sweden, where most employers also support the idea of collective agreement. Tesla has declined to speak to the BBC about the strike. The company may fear that an agreement with Swedish workers would strengthen the hand of the unions in the US, where Tesla employs tens of thousands. For Swedes like Hanna Ericsson, there's the fear that giving in to Tesla could lead to a gradual erosion of the Swedish model.
We are about 70 people ready to defend it for as long as it takes, because I want my children to have a fair workplace.
That report was by Tim Mansell. Still to come.
At least one or two walls and the minaret are damaged. That's all I know. But I do know that the Al-Omari Mosque has been restored over centuries, many times, and I think it can be restored again.
Rebuilding some of Gaza's threatened ancient treasures. US-Venezuelan relations appear to be deteriorating fast. The USS Gravely has just been added to the ever-growing list of US warships floating off the coast of Venezuela, stoking fears that a full-scale land invasion could happen. America says it's conducting a war against drug traffickers, but Venezuela's Attorney General, Tarek William Saab, who's a close ally of President Nicolas Maduro, says that's rubbish.
This is not an issue of democracy. It's about taking away Venezuela's gold, oil, copper and iron. Venezuela is one of the richest countries on the planet. These aren't threats to supposedly seek regime change in a democracy out of nowhere. No, it's to seize our country's natural resources and turn Venezuela into a US colony. And obviously our people aren't going to accept it now because they don't accept being robbed. They're going to murder a people. I think the world has to wake up.
My colleague Lise Doucet asked Chris Sabatini, Senior Fellow for Latin America at the London-based think tank Chatham House, what's on President Trump's agenda.
The Trump administration is trying to scare the military into defecting and moving Maduro and his top ministers to pave the way potentially for a transition. Now, whether that could happen, given the levels of corruption, which the Trump administration is correct, are there, it would be a difficult call. There probably will be land strikes, but it's difficult to imagine the U.S. will invade.
You mentioned about the defections. There's been this huge bounty that's been offered. Nobody's taken it up as far as we can see. And of course, the Venezuelans, the government points to this and said, see, nobody's interested in collaborating with the U.S.
That is not true. The truth is that the Maduro government, and this is actually the flaw in the Trump administration's plan, quite frankly, is that the government is deeply complicit in all levels of corruption, whether it's illicit gold mining, cocaine trafficking, human trafficking, and money laundering. So since they're all deeply complicit, it's really unlikely. And the fact that defection in, for past military officers has brought a very high cost. They've been jailed. Their families have been jailed. One former officer actually was killed and dismembered in Chile. So it's a very difficult regime to break from because it is a brutal, repressive, corrupt regime.
Can you visualize some kind of invasion, some kind of military activity that could possibly succeed?
A full invasion is very unlikely. Venezuela is a country of 28 million people and a very difficult terrain. You also have a number of criminal groups that are engaged in all sorts of illicit activities that would obviously fight back as well. You have multiple urban centers, so it would certainly not be an easy campaign. And as we know from Trump's campaign in 2016, he's against forever wars. And what he would be doing is really opening up a real can of worms in terms of trying to put the country back together. The hope, I'm assuming, is to launch a few drones or missiles, maybe strike some airports. Maybe if they really want to be risky, drop a few missiles on Fuerte Tiuna, which is where Nicolas Maduro lives, and maybe take out a few military barracks. I think that's on the more extreme end of the escalation. But yes, I think we will be seeing land strikes soon, but no invasion. It's going to be interesting to see how they get out of this. At a certain point, if the military doesn't defect, Trump is going to have to declare a victory in some way, and they may end up going back to the negotiating table. But quite frankly, the Maduro government in the past has shown little willingness to actually negotiate, certainly concede power. The question is, will this be enough to bring them back in earnest to the negotiating table?
Chris Sabatini, talking to Lise Doucet. India and China have resumed direct flights 5 years after they were suspended. They stopped at first because of the COVID pandemic, but the flights didn't start again due to deadly clashes between the two armies on the disputed Himalayan border a few months later. Now, a passenger flight from the eastern city of Kolkata has landed in the southern Chinese city of Guangzhou. One of the 180 passengers on board the special Indigo Airlines flight was Jacinta Sureka, a trustee from St. Joan's School of Kolkata. She says she's waited a long time to make this journey to China.
We've got a few partnerships in China, and because there were no direct flights, things have been quite difficult for our students to travel. And we've been now teaching Mandarin in the school for the past 2.5 years. And the partnership that we're going to sign is with a university in Shenzhen, called Shenzhen University. This partnership is more to do with language and cultural training.
I asked our global affairs reporter, Ambarasan Etarajan, how important this development is for India-China relations.
It is another step towards a normalization of ties between these two Asian giants. It is the first direct flight to mainland China. As you know, India and China have a very strong trade. The bilateral trade stands at about $130 billion. It's the second biggest trading partner after the US. So that means you have thousands of people, businessmen and traders, going to China, especially mainland China. And India depends heavily on China for pharmaceuticals, car spare parts, you name anything, it comes from China. And the trade deficit is like about $100 billion. So it is a good news for business travelers because they were taking detour, taking like a transit route via Singapore or Kuala Lumpur and other places. And also for students, there are about 25,000 students, many of them doing medicine. So for India, what they're saying is it will help people-to-people contact and boost trade relations as well.
Ambarasan Etarajan. The breakneck speed with which Donald Trump negotiates and renegotiates trade deals around the world can be hard to keep up with. But at the heart of each deal are industries that are being forced to adapt. For India's billion-dollar carpet industry, the 50% tariff it's been facing since August is proving crippling. Nearly 100,000 people have lost their jobs in its major carpet hub, Bhadohi, in the north. The BBC's Davina Gupta reports.
This sound has been a constant companion for 26-year-old Anil Maurya for over a decade. He's using a handheld electric machine and weaving a blue-coloured flower from a woolen yarn on a carpet. He's paid daily wages by local contractors to make carpets that travel mostly to America. And now Trump's tariffs have dealt a heavy blow.
"2 months ago, I was making $180 a day. Now I barely make 80. My sister has had to drop out of college. She's getting married now. We've taken a loan to cover the expenses. I've never had to borrow money before, and I'm scared. If I fail to repay it, they'll take my land. Where will we go?"
Well, Anil tells me if the situation doesn't improve, he'll have to leave home and family to search for work in the city. And he's not the only one. There are over 3 million people who are doing similar work of carpet weaving and are facing many more difficulties in this region.
In another home, I meet 45-year-old Prema Devi, weaving carpets entirely by hands.
I'm sitting beside Prema in her cramped workspace and my back is hunched and there's barely room to move around here. There's only one window for light and air, and Prema is sitting with three other weavers on a slim wooden bench. Her hands are constantly moving on the loom, and it's 4 p.m. now. She's been at this place from 8 a.m.
"Our situation is really bad. We are not making any money. We got work after 10 days. We have been surviving on chili salt and bread."
Her four children depend on what she earns. But with so little work coming in, she's thinking of giving it up.
"If this continues and we don't make money, we will have to close the loom and work as farm laborers."
An estimated 100,000 people have lost their jobs in this region in the past 2 months. And those still trying to work are desperate for orders. But carpet manufacturers say their hands are tied. Among them is Aslam Habib,
Our buyers have asked us to hold their orders until there's clarity on the US tariffs. This puts us in a very difficult position. Each carpet involves at least 22 separate processes, which means 22 or more people are employed in making a single piece. If these high tariffs continue, the industry could shrink by 30% to 40%, impacting tens of thousands of workers, especially in the villages.
And that's worrying for the industry. For centuries, families here have passed down the carpet weaving skills from one generation to the next. And now, as tariff politics continue between India and the US, it's not only their livelihoods, but the very legacy of their craft is at stake.
Davina Gupta reporting. Last week, when a massive global Amazon outage caused large parts of the internet to stop working, attention was focused on Loudoun County in the US state of Virginia. The area is home to the world's biggest number of data storage centres, vast processing facilities which are being built to power the internet and artificial intelligence. The businesses contribute billions to the local economy, but the centres dominate the landscape. They also create a humming or buzzing noise which people who live close to them say is ruining their quality of life. Anna Fagey went to Loudoun County to hear what it's like to live in the shadow of the huge buildings without ever-present buzz.
Loudoun County was once filled with farmland and developments of homes, until a few years ago, when data centers owned by companies like Amazon moved in. All you see is huge industrial concrete buildings, and trapped in the middle are thousands of the county's residents. I'm on my way to meet Greg Perio, who bought his home 14 years ago. When he looks out his townhouse window, what once was a green forestry is now a large blue building.
That's the data center that they built, and you can see how mammoth it is. And sometimes there's a whole other decibel level that can occur that makes it even louder.
Loudoun County is the wealthiest county in the U.S., reaping the benefits from its closeness to the U.S. capital, Washington, D.C., and its many data centers. But these centers are not the best neighbors. Greg says, on top of the impact on the environment, their quality of life is severely impacted.
I have some neighbors who said that they get headaches from it. A neighbor had to put a mattress over his window to keep the sound out so he could sleep.
Greg lives in an area that has the most data centers in the world. More than two-thirds of the global internet traffic passes through it.
It comes down to when the internet was in its infancy.
This is Thomas Hyslop, a cybersecurity expert from the University of South Florida. He knows why Northern Virginia attracts so many data centers.
Northern Virginia was really an epicenter for the growth of the internet. And so naturally they have the talent, they have the people already there. It was just easier to make them there.
In addition to this, tax breaks and government infrastructure in Northern Virginia create perfect conditions for the data centers. With tech companies racing to dominate the AI sector, places like Loudoun will continue to grow. And the industry is also getting a boost by President Donald Trump, who plans to loosen regulations around AI infrastructure. For the residents who are forced to live next to these centers, there's not much else to do but move away or fight against it. So far, with little success.
Anna Fagey. When it comes to the future of Gaza, if peace is ever agreed, the priority will be rebuilding basic infrastructure, like the hospitals and schools. But what about the sites that tell the story of Gaza's history and Palestinian identity? My colleague Edward Sturton discussed the importance of Gaza's heritage with the Palestinian writer Raja Shahadeh and his wife, the academic Penny Johnson.
In the Al-Omari Mosque, which started as a Philistine site, then was a Byzantine church, then was a 7th century mosque. It gives a sense of what Gaza was, this crossroads of civilization, that you're not a person stuck in a building that you cannot move. You're a person that has a civilization that you can think about, you can draw from. And I think that's what these sites can give people.
And just staying with the Great Mosque in Gaza, in Gaza City, do we know at all how it has survived, how much damage has been done there?
There's quite a lot of damage, but of course, we've just seen the photos. We've had no access except for the intrepid Palestinian journalists who are sending these photos. Nobody has been able to visit. It needs archaeologists, it needs restorers. At least one or two walls and the minaret are damaged. That's all I know. But I do know that the Al-Omari Mosque has been restored over centuries, many times, and I think it can be restored again.
The other place was the Church of St. Hilarion, is that right? Tell us a little bit about that.
It's actually a monastery site. It's the only UNESCO World Heritage Site in Gaza, but UNESCO has put it on a sort of danger of destruction list. It's an important site, beautiful mosaics. I don't know if they're still there. But Reggie was also talking about St. Porphyrius, which is the oldest Christian church, I think, in the world.
In the world.
Which is partially damaged in Gaza City. It's sort of good fortune that one of the great archaeological collections in Gaza moved to Paris before the war for an exhibit. So these important artifacts are saved. One of the great flukes of fortune.
Well, you know, the people in Gaza now are so involved in trying to survive day to day that I don't think they are thinking of the bigger questions. And I think they are just concentrating on survival at this point.
Which is, of course, absolutely understandable. But you think it's important that some of these places and the things associated with them in the longer term are preserved?
Yeah, because they are not only for the Gazans and for the Palestinians, they are a world heritage thing. They are important for the world. Because Gaza is a place that has been inhabited for 3,000 years, continuously. It's a very important place, historically and universally.
The Palestinian writer Raja Shahada and his wife Penny Johnson, talking there to the BBC's Edward Sturton. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at BBC World Service. Use the hashtag Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Derek Clark and produced by Paul Day and Wendy Urquhart. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.